Gary Tia at his office in downtown Portland, Oregon, the interviewer for the Oregon Historical Society's Clark Hansen. The date is 6/11/98, and this is tape 61A, side one. We were talking about timber relief.
Yes. But basically, we're talking about the timber industry and the beating they've taken and where we would be today. We were talking about, at that time, and that was a salvation. Again, we were able to manage and stave off at least disaster, and I consider what's happened to the timber industry a disaster. Mm-hmm. For some period of time, and it was necessary at the time. But it comes back again to when I kept talking about economic development. It's people think of that as some kind of an abstract term, but to me it meant jobs for people. That's what it meant to me. Mm-hmm. I recall I had a press conference and was really ridiculed. I have forgotten what the number was, but I had a press conference stating that we had just gotten this company to open up and they were going to employ 35 people. And the media, you know, said, 35 people? I thought that was exciting news. You know, we were losing jobs. You know. Mm-hmm. Howdy. And so I worked at that and worked at it real hard. But that to me was very big news. The media didn't think much of it. I went to Detroit on the Saturn program, mm-hmm. and it was funny to me. The media said, why are you doing that? And my answer to them is, why not? Is there something wrong with Oregon? You know, I didn't have this inferiority complex about the state of Oregon. I think they would be lucky. Saturn would be lucky to get us. That's the way I looked at it. Uh-huh. But in other words, I was always feeling upbeat about my state, the people in my state, and it was essential that they get jobs. And the hard part for any governor is to get it spread around the state. To me, if, for example, if somebody graduates from school in Hermiston, Oregon, and wants to stay in Hermiston, Oregon, then they should have that opportunity. Well, that's not always possible. I know that. And so we work hard to spread business around the state of Oregon. But to me, people should be able to, you know, like me, Portland. I'm born and raised in Portland, and of course I had our family business, but others are born and raised here, and they can stay here if they want to. Why shouldn't everybody have that opportunity? Well, it's not possible, but we work hard at it and try to get that job done.
Well, one of the remarkable things about the diversification and the economic recovery that Oregon went through was that it wasn't just a Portland phenomena. Deschutes is the fastest growing county in the state. Brookings has one of the fastest growing retirement communities. Ashland and Medford are growing significantly. Klamath Falls, other places in eastern Oregon are having significant amount of growth and very successful economies.
It's working. It takes a long time, but it's working, and there's benefit, getting benefits around the state of Oregon, and that's always important to get that job done. But like I told you now, Clark, is that the ones that have gotten all this hoorah were the ones that cleaned up of the Willamette River, land use planning, and that's the natural resource side of it. And I think that's important, and Oregonians believe it's important, and I believe it's important. But I said, and I said it, but nobody paid any attention, that I was going to be dealing with the human resource side of it, and that I wanted to put as much excitement, as much of an aura of being just this is really great stuff, on the human resource side. Mm-hmm. Obviously didn't work that way, but that's okay. The point is that did happen, and Oregonians were able to get the jobs that they wanted to have. And Oregon has been, we've done so well. We started off with the first Japanese company was NEC. They actually announced for Oregon before I repealed the unitary tax. That, incidentally, was a very significant event, more so than anybody really appreciates. The Japanese companies had kind of bound themselves together, and they were not going to go to any state that had the unitary tax. And all the big companies. And we talked to NEC, and they were really interested in Oregon. And we showed them, first of all, I told them I was going to, you know, work to repeal the unitary tax. But we showed them how they could avoid the unitary tax. This is through our Department of Revenue in Richmond for a period of, I think it was 3 or 4 years. So that gave them, and then they announced, but the announcing was, first of all, we had not repealed the unitary tax, and they broke away from the other major companies that said, we're not going to go to a state that has a unitary tax. So I always feel a real soft spot in my heart for NEC. They took me at my word, they trusted me to get the job done, and I did get it done. And they all followed the Fujitsu and Seiko Epson, and now, oh gosh, we've got a whole lot of them. But the important thing is that they came here to create jobs, and Oregon has got the jobs. Interesting. Labor said, oh, we got these low-paying jobs. I said, well, my responsibility is to create the jobs. Oregonians can decide if they want to apply for them. They don't have to apply for these low-paying jobs. And I'm effectively saying to the union, hey, you know, whatever the pay is a lot better than nothing.
And I'm sure a lot of Oregonians did apply for those jobs.
Well, sure they did. That's what happened. And they weren't really that low paying. Well, maybe they were low paying in regard to $18 or $20 an hour, but those jobs didn't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. They just weren't there. So, anyway, now, unless you want me, I got some interesting things here. I think I've told you, in our history, meaning Oregon's history, we had 8 special sessions for the sole purpose of rebalancing the budget. I called half of them, 4, 3 in 1 year. You don't really need all these. I don't know why.
Well, I know that we have talked about some of this, but yeah, it's good to get to recap and review.
At this point in time, although I think it's going to change, I'm one of 4 governors who have served 8 full years.
The others being what? Mark Hatfield.
Mark Hatfield, Tom McCall, and Pennoyer, I think, way back in the turn of the century.
Gee.
Yeah. But I think that may change.
You're referring to John Kitzhaber.
Well, that's it. I don't want to. Well, it's not going to be published before the election anyway.
Well, no, and go ahead.
I think you gave me a good opportunity to blow my own whistle. At least what I've given is clues for anybody that wants to find out what the TIA record is like. But I must tell you, that I must honestly tell you, I'm very proud of it, and I sometimes feel, oh, I don't know, when people, they I don't get credit for, you know, we all hate eagles. I guess mine's a little bigger than I thought it was. But I want to make sure at least somebody's got my view of what happened in the state of Oregon. And you gave me a chance to do it.
Well, I hope that because of this and because of this other publication that might come out, that maybe you'll get a little more exposure.
Yeah, it could be.
Because now that Oregon has gone through so much of its success, maybe people will take a moment to reflect and see what the roots of that success were.
Oh, it may be. I hope so. I think some people know that, but not as many as maybe I think should. Anyway, I can feel a little more relaxed about the fact that I had the chance. That, remember, I told you there's some tape missing because you gave me this chance before.
That's right. That's right.
And so now you've given me the chance again. I appreciate it.
Well, another thing that was a big effort, and I know that this has been an effort for every administration, but it was trying to find the long-term solution to Oregon's school financing dilemma. And no governor has come up with a solution for that. And it's particularly sad in light of what's happened between our last interview and now.
You're right. It was interesting, Clark, that I had saved what I called my as-delivered speeches, meaning, not all of them, but what I call important ones. And what I had them bound, actually, I've got them bound in 3 volumes, and leather bound, it looks nice. And as I read through them, how many times to the legislature and state of the state, and I've talked about property tax relief, it amazed me how many times it showed up. And particularly after the last defeat of a property tax limitation, which was very narrowly defeated, and I said, this is our last chance, the last chance people are going to give us. Although they do, however, accuse the legislature of not having done anything, and that's not true. There's been many proposals sent to the people by the legislature and proposed by governors. And people say, well, we want to have some changes, but not this one. Now, well, it turns out they wanted ballot 5, which I think was a serious mistake. That was it. But you see, did the I call pandering in the sense that it appealed to the people that wanted property tax relief. And that's why I called for it, and that's why we kept working for it, and we knew there had to be property tax relief.
But you're saying it wasn't a balanced solution.
That's right, but there wasn't the other answer.
Right.
So most of them failed because there was the other answer, which is obviously a change in taxes. But they said, well, I don't want that one, or I don't trust you to just keep it that way. And it was interesting, as I always make speeches before, particularly with the tax plans, and I said, and it's locked in the Constitution. The interesting part was I began to realize that people didn't understand what that meant. I knew what it meant, meaning the only ones that could change it were the people of the state of Oregon, if it's in the Constitution. So you had to explain to people when you say that, you couldn't just say it's locked in the Constitution. You had to explain to them that the only way it could be changed is they had to change it. And then you say it's locked in the Constitution. Well, those things you learn as you move along.
Well, Hayakawa said that you're not vetoing the tax relief package of 1978, 79, and 80 was the decision that would haunt you most. Is that true?
Well, I don't think it haunted me the most, but it did haunt me. And it haunted me in the sense that, let me go back to what happened. In the development of my first budget, I'm going to use the word saved, $600 million. Now, what that really meant was, in the past, the governors would say, the accountants would say, for the 2-year period of time, you're going to have $1,000. And so then the legislature meets and they budget up to $1,000. Well, what I did was I didn't do that. I budgeted up $600 million short of what we predicted was going to come into the state of Oregon. My proposal was to return that to the taxpayers. Heaven forbid. What an awful thought that was. So then the legislature took that and created the property tax relief, where the homeowners and renters relief program, where they gave this to the property taxpayer. Well, that first of all gave money back to people who didn't need it, obviously. Everybody got that. Everybody got that. And a lot of people didn't need it. And so it was a kind of a millstone around our neck for many sessions, the whole idea of returning this money to the, and that's the part that bothered me. I said, if I had vetoed that. But why I didn't at that time was that was the only property tax relief program that was around. There was no other. I didn't have any others.
Well, what about the idea of having a rainy day fund? I mean, if we'd had a rainy day fund before going into the recession, do you think that would have helped us at all?
No. No. First of all, I don't believe in rainy day funds. Uh-huh. I don't believe in them. That's why we have special sessions. And so if we've got the money and we need to use that money, let's use that money. Let's not put it in mothballs. which effectively, that's what you're doing. You're just not out there helping anybody. And you can, and if you've got an excess, give it back to the taxpayers. They paid too much. This is what's in my head. Mm-hmm. Others don't believe what I'm telling you. And so I don't believe in a rainy day fund. I don't believe in it at all because, as I say, you can always call a special session. Now, we effectively have, although it's a small one, a rainy day fund because they always have, you always have your budget and you leave an ending balance. You know, you have three items. You have the budget, you have money appropriate to Ways and Means, the emergency board, or something that'll happen in between, and then an ending balance. And the ending balance is supposed to be this Linus blanket. But it's never a huge amount of money. It's just some money, and you can use some of it.
And that's used by the emergency board, right?
No.
No?
That will be in case something goes haywire, and then I'd call a special session, and I can use some of that money. So effectively, it's a small rainy day fund. The interesting part was I was on the emergency board once, and so I asked the unforgivable question when the agency would come and ask for some money. My question was, what's the emergency? Well, you're not supposed to ask those questions. Because agencies had figured out it was a lot easier to get money from the emergency board than it was from the legislature. So they'd wait till the session was over, and then they'd come. There was no such thing as an emergency, or very rarely. So I was only on it one time. I was never reappointed to the emergency board. But I don't believe in the rainy day fund. And matter of fact, Gordon Smith had this deal for education. You know, we put money aside. I think it's a tragedy to do that. I really do. I think that it was one or two things. You use it because it's essential to be used for state government, or if you've got too much, you give it back to the taxpayer because you always can start over 2 years again. Only 2 years away. Or if something happens in between, as it did during my administration, you call a special session. Well, apparently that's too simple an answer. Anyway, that's how I feel.
It's like all those legislative measures that are passed with the clause that it's an emergency, just in an emergency, not for the emergency board, but just in the regular sessions of the legislature. So I think that's so that it would be immediately applied. Is that right? Or immediately?
Yeah. That's right. It becomes law right after the session. Other than that, it's 90 days after the session, it becomes law.
Yeah.
So what you actually do is, these are mostly Ways and Means bills, and the reason for that is that the new biennium starts July 1 of that year.
Uh-huh.
So you have to have it available for the new biennium.
Right.
June 30th is the end of a two-year biennium. And July 1 starts another 2 years. So the legislature meets from January to whenever of the that new biennial year. So that's where it most often appears.
Since the legislature very rarely ever adjourns before the end of June now, even though it used to, but it no longer does, would it make any sense to move the fiscal year then up to what the federal government has done by the beginning of October so that there's no pressure on the legislature to get these Ways and Means bills through before the end of the session?
Yeah, two things. Well, first of all, I don't want to take pressure off the legislature.
Uh-huh.
So my answer would be no, right. Keep the pressure there. Mm-hmm. But Congress does some funny things. They don't even feel pressure. Mm-hmm. They either won't pass it or they'll pass a kind of a continuing resolution of some kind. And they can print money and do all kinds of funny things. But no, I would just keep pressure on. I'd keep it there. It's important to get that job done and get it out of the way.
I think it was Harry Boivin that said to me that they should just have a mandate that the legislature meets for no more than 90 days or whatever, because they'll get whatever they have to get done within that period of time. They'll just be a little more efficient about it. But
well, Harry's right. You know, I've said it was fascinating to me over the years that the state of Oregon lives just perfectly peaceable for 18 months, and then the legislature meets, and everything is wrong with the state. And so then they got to put all these bills to cure all these terrible things that have happened,
right.
Then they go home, and everything is perfectly peaceable again. We live another 18 months perfectly happy.
Maybe it'd be better not to have a legislature at all. Anyways, you know, I know that you've had some negative feelings about Goldschmidt because of his because of some of the things that he said that were critical of you. But one thing he did say was, quote, the thing you've got to remember about Attia is that he was elected by the greatest margin of any governor in modern times. And not that this is necessarily an accomplishment of yours, but it's still a sign, even though people may not give you credit for some of the things you've done now, at the time you were reelected, they were giving you credit then. And during a very difficult time when it would have been very easy to kick an incumbent out of office.
That's a personal pride for me. Mm-hmm. And actually, one of the reasons that I feel the way I feel, and let me tell you what that is. I've said to anyone that would listen, I've said this to the Republican caucus, that the most political thing you can do is to do what you think is right. And very few politicians, Republican or Democrats, really believe that. I'm sure some of them would resent my saying it, but they don't. What is it they want? What are the media says? Where is the pressure coming from? You know, all those kinds of things. I believe that people value honesty, integrity, openness, fairness. They value all of those things much more than whether they agree or disagree with you on an issue. I believe that. Mm-hmm. And if we why am I influenced? In 1982. Is when we hit the bottom of the recession. So we had, this is my re-election year. We had 12.6% unemployment in the state of Oregon. 1982, I called three special sessions to rebalance the budget, all of which included either cutting budgets or adding revenue or both. The last of them in September was the most controversial. That's where I took the state industrial action fund money. Very controversial. I'm running against a Kennedy-type, charismatic newcomer, you know, this is the comer of the Democrat Party. Nice, Ted's a nice fellow, good man, I like him. And history has shown he's served the state very well. But here I am, this stodgy, you know, non-charismatic guy. Election day was an absolutely beautiful, sunny day. All of those things were on that election year, 1982. The AFL-CIO didn't support me. OEA didn't support me. State employees didn't support me. Women's Caucus didn't support me. And I won by 62%. Now, of course, when I saw all those that didn't support me, that's the leadership, which means that the people in those groups obviously did. And, of course, that's the way I've always felt. I told you early on, you remember, you don't just say what you think they want to hear. You tell them who you are, and then you go ahead and do it. And if they like you, fine. If they don't, okay. So I'm very much in that mode. And that's why I see politicians today, you know, just tell the people the way it is. You know, that people are not stupid. For example, when I call a special session to rebound, they know we're in trouble. They know we have to do these things. So I said, yeah, I know we have to do them, and he's honestly telling us what we ought to get done. And maybe I don't agree with the way he did it, but I understand what he's doing and why he's doing it. And I value that more highly than I do whether I agree or disagree. So I really believe that. So I'm proud of that. I'm proud of the fact that that's the way it came down. And poor old Ted. He was a speaker at it was some event where I was. part of the introduction is, you know, and anyone, the election of 19 with the biggest margin, and Ted says, "What, you know, why do we have to see?" He's a speaker.
Right.
You know, why do they have to keep bringing that up?
Well, you know, it's interesting in that, you know, my discussions with Bob Packwood about this, he said that Ted was probably the toughest opponent he's ever had. And because of his style of aggressive style of campaigning, and you had the same opponent, and that's the margin you won by. So it is remarkable.
It's good. Well, I wish other politicians would take a page, a leaf out of that page, and conduct their their service in that manner.
You know, one thing that John Kitzhaber said, and of course this is long before he was governor, was that, quote, it was one of the high points of his governorship, having the political courage to reverse 20 years of opposition to a sales tax, end quote. And that was a remarkable achievement, in that you had been so vociferously opposed to sales tax, and that you were able to, you're talking about politicians being honest with the way they feel. Well, hardly, most of politicians will not reverse themselves, regardless of whether it makes sense or not. And for your having done this, it is a rather remarkable achievement.
Well, that's right. It's hard for me to kind of pinpoint it. I've always been who I am. I haven't tried to be something I'm not. I did believe for a long time about sales tax. I studied it. I worked hard at taxation. I told you earlier I worked on the bill in case it ever passed. It's got to be a good one. This, however, was not just a sales tax, although that's the way it came out. This was a tax package which, in my way of thinking, was the best tax package I ever saw. It did include reduction of the income tax. It did include property tax relief. It was all of those elements were in that package. It was a good one. But people saw sales tax, and they automatically they turn off their brain. That's all you have to say is sales tax. You don't have to. That's all you have to say. So it failed, but that's why I did it. But trouble. Sometimes my business friends, they were just down on me, something awful. I knew what I was going to do. I knew what had to be done. I went ahead and did it. And I see some, they just back at Congress, they always, or the president appoints a task force, or that's a lot of nonsense. I got a problem. I got something to deal with. Let's go do it.
How do you feel about the prospects in the future, since the sales tax, since you left office, has failed a couple times more, and we're still in the same dilemma with our schools, and what is your prognosis for on that front?
I can't see where the people are going to pass anything with a sales tax in Oregon. I don't see any future for it. They still don't believe there's a real problem generally out there. I've talked to Barbara Roberts several times, and I was effectively saying to her, because she came in right after ballot 5 had passed, and I said, "Barbara, you've got to, explain to Oregonians that there's a problem out there. Until they really believe and understand how serious the problem is, they're not going to vote for anything. You can't come up with a tax plan." And they'd say, my business friend said, "Okay, now, we're going to send them a message, come up with a sales tax." This is before the election. I said, "I don't know what you're talking about. You're trying to tell me that if the people vote to lower their property taxes, you can come right back and say, now that you've lowered your taxes, would you vote for this handy-dandy sales tax?" See, they're going to say you're crazy. So they've got to understand that there's a problem out there. And if they do understand it, Oregonians will respond.
Well, in fact, she did back off, didn't she?
Well, but that's not the point. The point is that she didn't explain to them first that we've got a problem. You can't say, "We've got a problem, here's my solution." Yeah, she did back off, but the point is, you've got to explain first to Oregonians that we've got a problem. Then you can say, and after they believe we've got a problem, and they do not yet believe that, then they'll vote to solve it. They're smart enough.